Hey there, fellow seekers. I am so glad you're here. I'm Mix Punk Rogers, and welcome to Freaks and Ferals, the Firekeepers podcast. It's our third episode, and today we're heading out on a transformative journey with the remarkable Sadie Whipp. Unconventional, even in strange spaces, Sadie is not one to be pinned down or put in any kind of box. She is a beacon of wisdom in our collective quest for belonging and inner security. She invites us to reclaim our birthright, the profound sense of connection that comes from being in relationship with all of life. Her wisdom is a healing balm for the weary human, offering comfort and inspiration simultaneously. Sadie Whipp has often been called the teacher's teacher and the healer's healer. Sadie is a writer, mentor, and strange creature who has worked with thousands of people over more than 35 years. At just 7 years old, Sadie became dedicated to this path. Witch, healer, hierophant, Sadie has spent her entire life in feral devotion to the deeper powers of this world. Sadie's goal is to help people root and center in the greater ecosystem of relational belonging. Her clients are teachers, healers, artists, oracles, and witches from all over the planet. I discovered Sadie when I was lost in the confusion and darkness of the Western maze, searching for clarity about the way forward. Her wisdom became my compass until I could find my own. Sadie is a guardian of the sacred, a weaver of weirds, and a fierce advocate for our collective awakening. Her words are like lanterns in the darkness, guiding us back to our forgotten path, leading us to the root of our existence. I can't wait for you to meet her. So let's fire it up. Hi, welcome, Sadie.
Thank you for having me.
Really excited to be in this conversation with you.
Me too.
So what led you to exploring the concept of relationality and its significance in our lives? And how does it relate to this thing called spirituality?
Okay, that's a big question. So the relationality thing, it wasn't like something that I came upon in myself. It was something that I noticed that was missing when I was seven. My mom, my aunt, and my uncle were standing in our dirt driveway. I grew up on a ranch. They were standing in the dirt driveway talking about something, and it was early summer. And I remember seeing them talking. There's cows grazing in the field. There's a little, little butterfly bobbing through the air. The crabapple tree's going. The cats are lounging around. The dog's taking a nap. And I had this very palpable sense that they were not in the same thing that the rest of us were in. It was like almost like I could see this weird distortion around them that wasn't allowing them to even notice everything else that was connected and relational. And it really struck me. And I took a vow right then and there on that, in that dirt, to figure out why humans are so disconnected and why they aren't living in the same reality that the rest of us are living in. And so that was when I started noticing the relationality piece. And I, in my seven-year-old mind, I mean, it wasn't as sophisticated at 55 now. Back then, it wasn't as sophisticated. But in my seven-year-old mind, I believed it was the cause of misery, of like why people were so unhappy and why they were miserable and why they harmed other beings and stuff like that, is because they were just missing what everything else lives in. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it wasn't like some study I engaged in or something like that. It was that I never lost connection to relationality. And I got old enough that I was able to see non-relationality in the humans around me. And that began my exploration. So I just committed my life to helping people get more connected. And then what was the second or third part of your question?
So yes, well, let me tell you the curiosity or the interest that I had about this question was the fact that spirituality is often, you know, put in this kind of set aside thing, right? It often gets intermixed with religion, right? And yet mm-hmm. when you are talking about spirituality, you're talking about relationality. You're talking about something that's much more Absolutely. Immediate, much more kind of, what's the word? Like, accessible, right? It's much more mm-hmm. like cross, even cross-cultural than that, if that's the mm-hmm. right word.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I guess that's kind of where my question was coming from. But it sounds like in your story, your first experience of spirituality was already fused with this relationality. But for most folks out there, they may not see that connection. And so,
yeah.
I mean, we're going to talk obviously more about that. But I guess as an mm-hmm. overarching sort of setting the tone or setting, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, so I define spirituality as having a relationship with something greater than yourself. That's it. And the only reason I even say that is because we have language that fundamentally is reductionist and sort of dismembering. So we say body, mind, spirit, because we are conceptualizing them as separate things. We dismantle and dismember wholeness. And so our language reflects that. So I think in the English language and certainly Latin-based languages, we don't have appropriate terms. So, I mean, if I had my druthers, I wouldn't even say spirituality. I would just say relationality. But relationality for many people is actually a spiritual experience. Like it's so profound and it's so enriching and it's so nourishing that it kind of goes into that spiritual experience category. And I've been more and more stepping away from terms like that and just really talking about being relational, however that looks for you, but being more relational with the world around you, not just with humans. So, you know, if it were up to me, we would get rid of those words and those delineations, but I don't know what we would replace them with because I'm not a linguist and I don't know how to do that. So,
totally.
You know what I mean?
I mean, and this has been my experience. And I feel like, I guess my concern in terms of titling this thing for folks was like, if it's labeled as spirituality, how does that shift, you know, who ends up listening and who doesn't, you know? And what sort of kind of prejudice or judgments are people coming in with even just using that word? It feels a little loaded. And so that's why I wanted to kind of.
Well, so is relationality.
Yeah, say more.
Yeah. So is relationality because it's like relationality that is like eco-relational. You know, there are people who believe that it's nuts to revere or regard a tree or an earthworm or a dog or a cat or whatever, the wind. It's, first of all, it's nutty to even consider that a rock or a wind is something you could be relational with when it's not one-sided, that there's an actual exchange there based in consciousness and connection and relationship and community. So that's already just completely nuts to a lot of people. It's so irrational. And then you have just being relational with the world around you and caring about the world around you and not centering yourself in this hierarchy or centering yourself that you're the sort of center point of, you're the reference point for all life, for all intelligence, for all, you know, emotional navigation, for all the things. So a lot of people just think, I think there are people who would say that relationality is less reasonable than spirituality, you know, because spirituality, you can just, you can see it as a coping mechanism to have relationship with some thing that you've imagined to give yourself comfort and be able to navigate the world. But with relationality, you're actually saying the beings around you have intelligence and that there is intelligence in all things. And I think that modern Western minds especially have a really hard time with that. So,
well, that's actually my next question, yeah, is what factors contribute to this resistance?
What I feel like is that it's sort of, I think that we don't often think very much about how we think. And I don't mean this in a disparaging way toward anyone. Every culture has embedded beliefs and assumptions that are invisible. They're embedded, meaning we don't notice them. We just take it for granted that they're true. Like gravity, right? We take it for granted that it's true. We now have scientific proof. But things like being rational and certain ways of knowing things as better than, for example, say being relational or being mythical or being living through stories. And I feel like the Western cultural MO is we sort of use like rational, logical, reductionist, hyper scientism in everything. That the invisible assumption is that being rational is the right tool for the job all the time. And I don't think that that's questioned very often. Like even in relational discussions between partners, one partner will say, you're being overly emotional, you're not being rational. As if being rational is somehow better or somehow the right way to be in an emotional relationship discussion. It's ridiculous. So you've got a society of people, everybody's got a hammer and they're running around trying to hit everything and not questioning if the hammer is the best tool, the right tool, whatever. So one of the things I talk about, I recommend this to clients all the time. I talk about it in my book, which is keeping an evidence journal. And it's really, instead of imposing our version of what we believe the world is onto the world around us, we start to allow for the possibility of curiosity and being surprised. And we write down what we notice so we can discover what's really going on rather than assume we know and assume that the cultural frameworks that we use are accurate all the time for everything. And I think that's really important. And I think that a lot of people are walking around in a very critical mind, using criticism like, is that true or not true? What do I think that's valid or not valid? And I might use the term that's very arrogant. And our Western methodology is extraordinarily arrogant. And it's based on knowledge and who's right and all of these things. But when you get into squishy territory, relationships are very squishy territory. And, you know, you have to have a little bit of intellectual humility to kind of find out what's actually possible and what's going on there, or else you're just not going to be able to perceive it. And it's always funny to me when someone tells me something that I've experienced my entire life isn't real because it doesn't match up with what their cultural expectation says life is, instead of ever questioning if they have the ability to perceive the things I have the ability to perceive. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? It's always like they're right, not that they're questioning if they even have cultivated an ability to perceive any of these things. If they even know how they would approach relationship with outside of the human realm and outside of human hierarchy. It's never questioned. It's always just presumed this is right. And I'm comparing all of that to this. And if it doesn't match up, it's wrong. It's like, that's not very intelligent. It's understandable, but it's not very intelligent. And people do it all the time. So we miss a lot. And we don't know we're missing a lot because it feels better to be right than to not know. Much more comfortable.
Well, and I will just reiterate the evidence journal thing, because that's been a practice that I've taken up because of you. And
right on.
Completely changed my perspective, because I had always done kind of the prescribed gratitude journal, you know, where you're supposed, like, you, maybe it's a daily practice, or maybe you're told to practice it, or it's a suggestion to practice it if you're feeling really down. Mm. And it's a way to kind of perk yourself up, you know, see the things around you that you actually really should be grateful for, and not be focusing on those things that aren't working, right? Or are causing you pain. Mm. And how forced that is. What a forced thing that is, instead of, you know, that just kind of slaps a band-aid on things, instead of this noticing what's real, what's really happening around you, and being that co-creator with the universe, whatever it is beyond us, that is conspiring for our well-being. Or
it's not always conspiring for our well-being. It's conspiring. It's conspiring for the well-being of the ecosystem, right? And if you're a member of the ecosystem that is making the ecosystem sick or whatever, you know, I mean, we're all, this is the thing. I know that it's very kind of like, I think a lot of humans really don't like this idea, especially with 2000 years of like, we're the chosen, you know, people in some way, we're the special people in some way, whatever those Abrahamic faiths can imply. And this idea of like, you're part of the ecosystem and you are not preferenced over everything else can feel terrifying. And I think that it feels terrifying largely because we're not in right relationship with the world around us. And it's like the monster under the bed. We imagine, like, if I'm not preferred, I'm then going to be attacked or antagonized. But if we're part of the ecosystem, like, we have our life cycle and we have our participation in it. And eventually, you know, there's not a preference there, though. And I think that really freaks humans out, that we're not preferred. It doesn't mean that we're ignored. It doesn't mean that we're not held. It doesn't mean we don't belong. It just means when we conflate preference with safety, right? We conflate preference with safety, then we don't actually learn how it is in order to go, I don't have to be like the chosen golden child in order to have a place in the world. I belong as much as everything else, you know, I'm part of this. So I think even this idea that the universe is working toward our benefit is like, no, it's working toward the benefit of the ecosystem. And if you're smart, you learn to be ecosystemically oriented and get in right relationships so that you're provided for in that systemic intelligence way, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. But it's kind of weird. Like, I think it's very scary to get over yourself as the peak thing, because you have to confront how scared you actually are being alive and how tiny you actually are and how big and terrifying life can be at times. Like, we kind of have to confront that to get to the place where we can accept that we're part of the ecosystem. And if we're not willing to do that, and it's easy to say, not easy to do. If we're not willing to do that, then we have to have these constructs that like reassure us that we're okay, because we don't have the experience that we're okay because we're not engaging the ecosystem relationally. So we don't have any experience to back it up. So we have to have hopes and beliefs and ideas that we create that we're safe, you know? And I think that that fear is very real. Like, people talk about, oh, what's your purpose? And like living your purpose and living your truth and being authentic. But it's not common vernacular. It's not common for us to say, confront how scared you are. It's okay to be scared. It doesn't mean anything. It's just freaking scary to be alive at times, you know, and that's okay. But you don't see, it's all these like highfalutin concepts, and we're not just addressing this base issue that's causing us to be disconnected because we're too scared to be connected because we don't know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
So even with the best intentions, we are heavily conditioned by Western ideals and are often unaware of behaviors that lead to dehumanization. We may struggle with the difference between transactional and relational interactions. Recognizing these patterns is crucial. And in your recent video on spiritual teachers, you emphasized the importance of practical guidance. And asking our teachers for specific how-tos in unlearning these ingrained behaviors. Given our indoctrination into Western paradigms, it's likely we're unfamiliar with some alternative ways of being. And so what cues or feelings can alert us to the onset of dehumanization and objectification in ourselves and others? Like, how does this manifest in our relationships?
Yeah. I think first and foremost, it's a lack of awareness of how much we're living in a story versus living as a responsive arising. So what I mean by that is, like, if I have moral ideas, if I have spiritual ideas that I strive for or that I invest in, I, rather than being in a moment and seeing what arises in that moment, I will impose and perform those ideas onto a moment, right? So we do that a lot. Like, we can be very manipulative when we are living in a story. Like, for example, if there's conflict, I have a conflict with this person, I need to address it with them. I don't want them to get super angry at me. So I'm going to do things to manipulate them to have the result that I want, but I'm not going to talk to them about it. I'm not going to ask their permission. You know, I'm just going to perform this thing on them to get them to be how I want my story to go. And I think that it's very difficult to become aware of your story, because most of us have relationships all by ourselves and we don't even know what genuine relationship feels like. So, and we're very quickly reactive. So like, if you and I are having a conversation and you bring up something with me that is confronting or is like, hey, this is uncomfortable, or something happened that's not cool with me, can I talk with you about it? Right. I might take that and start to just try and appease you or try and calm you down or try and, or I might be defensive, I might gaslight you. There's all these things I might do instead of just being honest, right? So it's like our honesty is buried under so many reactive layers that we don't even realize we're performing on somebody and we're not engaging them. So engaging someone might be like, first of all, just notice when you're anticipating stress, or you have hope in a conversation, you want a particular outcome. Instead of just doing that to someone, you tell somebody, I have a particular outcome I want it to achieve. And I'm noticing I'm trying to figure out how to get you to go into that outcome. And I don't know how to just talk with you honestly. Would you be willing to engage me around some honest conversation and be aware of my little landmines I might pepper into the conversation? Because I feel very scared. I feel intimidated, or I feel this feels really high risk, or I feel like there's a power imbalance. Like I want relationship with you and you don't want it with me. You know, we're not giving other people a chance to respond to us and a chance to decide how they want it to go. We don't talk about creating it together. We don't acknowledge those things. We just come in and perform our story. And if the person doesn't perform our story according to the way we think it should go, we use all kinds of tactics, all these tactics, whether it's manipulating or guilt or blame or shame. Those are some favorite Western tactics. You know, people know about gaslighting. We use power trips. We quote rules. We quote, that's not reasonable. You're not being logical. We do all these things to try and coerce the story and massage it into what we want. And that's never alive. That's never relational. You know, it's just us living in isolation. And you have all these people that are depressed and lonely and all these things when they have people around them who love them. They go, I don't know why I'm so lonely with all these people. Must be me, or, you know, life must suck, or it must be this thing. It's like, just because you have a bunch of people around you doesn't mean you're having connection. Doesn't mean you guys are actually being relational in any kind of way that you're touching. You've got a big story bubble between the two of you. You can't feel somebody when you're so focused on the story and not the actual other person. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know that one very, very intimately. Yeah, I think that people get really terrified of doing that. I mean, you're talking about being vulnerable, like in the moment, being transparent.
Yeah.
And
and it feels very vulnerable, which is kind of weird. It's like, why does being honest and being truthful with somebody and giving them space to respond the way that they choose to respond vulnerable? Like, why is that vulnerable? It should just be normal. Why is it such a big deal? It's such a big deal because we do everything but that, right? We're not just honest.
We're out of practice, maybe.
We're out of practice with being honest and navigating that territory. It's not like you just tell someone the truth. You have to have skillfulness, and you have to have a sense of the other person, whether it's a human person or not, that they're valid the way that they are. Like, that's a fundamental tenet of basic respect, is you have to be able to see another being as valid the way that they are. Otherwise, you're going to come across as critical or demeaning or condescending or controlling or manipulative or disapproving or rejecting or abandoning or any other number of things, because you don't see them as valid, you know? And if your position of what makes a valid person is actually socially upheld as well, if there's a lot of like social power around that, then what happens is the other person is then put in a position to, in a way, kind of fight for their life, where they're now having to answer to the great decider of validity and prove that they're valid. And like, what a terrible thing to do to someone is that, using their valuable life force to say it's okay that I exist the way that I am, you know? And yet we do that all the time. Like, are you a female the right way? Are you, you know, whatever your skin color is the right way? Are you your age the right way? Are you, like, is your body the right way for the way it's supposed to be? Is it, you know, there's all these, like, do you believe the right way? There's all these things as if there's some baseline. And whoever has a strong affiliation with the socially agreed upon baseline has an enormous amount of power behind them. So it's not like you're just one-on-one with a person. If you're not aligned with those baselines and that social currency, then when you talk to somebody who is, they have a massive field behind them that bears down on you, but they're not acknowledging it. They just feel substantiated. They feel they're right. They get a little power, trip out of it, right? And then they'll just go in. And it's not honest and it's not relational. It's prove that you have the right to exist the way that you are, or else. And the or else's in our society are, some of those or else's are deadly.
Well, it's really hard to not get sucked into.
Oh, yeah.
Because again, that machinery, you know, and get basically churned up by it. Trying to, substantiate your own humanity when it feels like such an offense, you know, like immediately to defend oneself in that situation. And, you know, like we need to. And in the same token, doing so gets us further and further into the quicksand with that person's trip.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I mean, how do we, sometimes it's, sometimes being honest, right? And being vulnerable is not the safest thing. So like, how do we extricate ourselves out of those situations? How do we recognize when it's a no-win situation too?
Yeah. Well, I think that first and foremost, becoming skillful with personal accountability and holding others accountable. So we've talked about this before, but I'll just say this, is that people are responsible for what comes out of their mouth. And in our culture, it's the way that we behave in our culture is that once it's out of my mouth, you're responsible for it, not me. So I can ask you any question or say anything and then just sit back and wait for you to answer. And that happens in insidiously subtle ways where we don't even realize that we are now responsible for what someone else says to us. And I think that learning to pause instead of just react, right? There's a lot of social currency around like fast reactions equal, you know, you get points if you react fastly and you lose points if you don't react fastly. Like you should just be able to like know everything and do everything and be skillful with everything or like, well, you're just, you know. So I think the first thing is really getting very grounded in this idea that other people are responsible for what comes out of their mouth and then becoming skillful with the fact of that. So if you say something to me, then you release something and then you sit back like, you have to answer my question. I can just say to you, oh, why do you ask? Very simply, not charged, not whatever. People could practice this. Just go watch your face in the mirror and just practice going, oh, why do you ask? Really neutral. And get, just start saying that to everything. Like somebody says, hey, do you like kumquats? Oh, why do you ask? Just start practicing it so that you can have a more immediate, like you get used to saying it and you get used to the experience of it not being a problem. So when you get into an actual charged situation where somebody's inappropriate, whether they're being power trippy or nosy or degrading or judgmental or whatever it might be, oh, why do you ask? And what you're doing when you say that to someone is you're letting them know they're responsible for their question and they need to answer. They need to answer you before you decide to privilege them with your response. You know what I mean? So you just, as simple as that, oh, why do you ask? It doesn't have to be this big, like whatever. And then make the person tell you. And if they don't give you a sufficient answer, if it doesn't feel authentic, just say, oh yeah, I'm not going to answer that. Or, oh yeah, no. You can just say, oh no. You don't have to be elaborate. You can just go, oh no. Oh, okay. Yeah, no. Not interested. Not interested in what? I'm not interested in answering your question. I'm not interested in responding to your statement. Like you could be nice about it. Right?
Yeah.
But so I think first and foremost, that's a huge thing is to flip that script and really get through your head, other people are responsible for what comes out of their mouths. And it's not your job to do that. And let other people be grownups. Let them be uncomfortable. Let them figure out why they're asking you something.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The other thing you can do if you feel like being a little more direct is I call it neutral reporting with a check-in. And so neutral reporting with a check-in is, say you say something to me, I'm going to take a breath and I'm going to notice how that feels in my body. And I'm going to notice what thoughts I have associated with that. And then I'm going to tell the person my body sensation first, because when you share the body sensation, you're instantly putting them in a state of resonance with you, whether they agree with you or not. You're instantly in a state of resonance. There's no reality battle, because everyone knows what it feels like to have tightening in your chest, clenching in your jaw, tension in your shoulders, butterfly in your stomach, making a fist. Everybody knows what that feels like. So I'm going to tell you, oh, Sid, I noticed when you said that, I got some butterflies in my stomach and I had the thought that you were criticizing me. Was that your intention? Right? So I'm not saying anything about you. I'm giving you a window into my process. I'm letting you know I got butterflies. My head did this thing. I'm not saying that's you. I'm not saying, oh, you're criticizing me. I'm saying, was that your intention? And I'm giving you an opportunity to say, oh, that wasn't my intention at all. Or as I've had some people say to me refreshingly, oh, yeah, sorry about that. That's actually what I was doing. Sorry about that. I'm like, cool, you want to regroup? Or do you just feel that way toward me? Because if you do, let's just stop. That's not interesting to me. If you're just in this, like, you just need to like be critical all the time. It's like, eh, whatever. Go have fun somewhere else. You know? And I've had a lot of clients over the years, when I give them this technique, many people will say, oh, I can't do that. And I'm like, you can't do that, or you believe that's not allowed. That's totally not okay to say. It's like, that's a cool thing about being a grown-up, is you can do whatever you want. Like, you actually can say that. And if you say it respectfully and with curiosity and spaciousness, but well-boundaried, you know, then cool things can happen and you're getting closer to being honest, mm-hmm. you know?
So. Well, two things come to mind. That the phrase that I've heard in many different circles, learning to stand with ourselves instead of against another person, and just how empowering that is. And I mean, the idea of it, it sounds really cool. And then you describe what that actually looks like in a scenario. And I can feel like even the fear in my own self, you know, as you describe doing that, because we're so oriented in Western culture to give authority over, right? And that authority is automatically, like you said, granted to the person with the question. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's mind-blowing. Hmm. It's mind-blowing to think about how we can just hold ourselves and not immediately like throw it back on the other person or run away or whatever, but stand with ourselves. And so that kind of brings me to the next thing, is this idea of capacity. So what kind of capacity do we need in order to just stand with ourselves, to say something that is so empowered? How dare we say something so empowered, right? So
right.
Where can we get that capacity?
Well, I mean, it takes a lot of practice. That's the thing. It's like the epiphany is not the transformation. So just because you get something doesn't mean you're transformed. And that implies there's work to do. And you have to have like space to be on a learning curve. We all need space to be on a learning curve. And you can give somebody the heads up. Like, I tell my clients, like, tell people you're going to change the rules before you just change the rules and then get butthurt when they get upset that you've changed the rules without telling them. So first of all, just tell people, hey, I'm practicing. I realize that I capitulate in conversation, or I realize I don't have good boundaries, or I realize that I give authority to whoever I'm talking to or whatever, and I'm going to be practicing not doing that. So I want to give you the heads up, and it's probably going to be pretty ungraceful and weird. Are you okay giving me that space? Or are you interested in participating in that with me? Or is that upsetting for you? Or like, how does that land for you? You know? And some people will say, no, I like the way things are. Red flag. And then other people will go, oh, it's about time. I'm super excited you're doing that. Yes, I would love to do that with you. Okay, great. And then just say, I don't want your feedback unless I ask. I don't want to be course corrected or coached or anything unless I ask. Right. So people don't go, oh, you should say it this way, or oh, that, oh, you did, you know, whatever. Just don't do that. And just like, it's going to be bumpy for a while, and I'm probably going to step on your toes. And I'm assuming you're a grown up and you can talk with me about anything you need to talk with, because I'm not going to manage your experience of me for you. Like, I'm doing my own work on myself. So I'm just giving you the heads up. It's going to change. Don't know what that's going to look like. Here's the gist of what I'm working on. And you're done. Right. And then I also think that we're so, in terms of how, like with capacity, so a lot of it is practice with an evidence journal, because, you know, our brains are the way that they are. We have the neurological pathways we have based on experience. So if you don't trust people to not be a jerk with you when you're honest, you're not making that up. Those are actually experiences that you've had in some. So it's learning how to trust other people and how to co-create with other people so that you guys can kind of tag team that. And when you do that, it's not one of the things that's been the coolest thing for me about people, about human people, is learning how, when you're honest, many human people will want to support and aid and help you in your vulnerability or in your honesty. And when that happens, whatever is in our body is now spread out to at least another person. So capacity isn't just this idea of like, oh, this is me, but I want to put a gallon in here and this is only a quart, so I have to be a gallon, right? That's a lot of people will approach that with like, toughen up or deal with it or get over yourself or whatever, rather than thinking about my capacity is also how my situation is spread out in the ecosystem and the people around me, you know? So it's engaging people as part of your capacity, part of your ability to have capacity, you know? Like, hey, I'm holding this thing all by myself and it's freaking me out and it's really hard. Will you hold this with me, you know? Like, yeah, and let's co-create what that might look like for you, you know? I think, yeah, and also growing your own capacity is important. Like, our nervous system, I think a lot of us, when you have a shock to your system before your system is fully developed, it leaves an imprint and tells you, don't let anything this big or this intense come in ever again. And we don't modify that to go, I can handle more because my system can handle more now. So as the energy starts to rise, we'll cut it off. We want to stop it because we imagine it won't ever stop. It's just going to get so intense, it'll blow our heads off our shoulders. And having the experience of learning to like sit through the intensity as it goes up and hits its own natural peak and goes away. Like, too often we're trying to control the energy, we're trying to control the experience rather than let it go. Like, it's going to do this no matter what we do, right? So it's going to do that. Somebody dies that you love and you care about, your grief process is going to go like this and like that, whether you sit there, whether you go to therapy, whether you punch holes in your wall, whether you run your car into a pole, no matter what you do, it's still going to do this. And there are things you can do to make it to be supported and to survive its natural arc, but it's going to be what it's going to be. And the more you go through it, the easier it gets. But it's going to have its own natural arc. But we think we have to control it. We think we have to, you know, and a lot of what life is, our capacity is keeping our head above water while life does itself and trying not to drown while that motion is going through our own life. So the capacity is also not being reactive, not getting shit-faced, not, you know, escaping in sex or drugs, not whatever. Or if you need to do those things, it's okay. I'm not saying those aren't tools, but not doing things that are self-destructive or things that are, you know, going to really harm us while this energy is moving through. That's also part of capacity, you know, or just making the healthiest choices we can with compassion. Like, I need to shut off now. So I'm going to take, you know, some Tylenol PM and just force my body to sleep so my nerves don't keep me awake or whatever it is. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think very few people actually have capacity because we live in stories and we don't know that our stories aren't reality. So then we imagine these things and then we start to react to our imagination. Rather than being curious. Curious is the antidote to almost all of these things. Just be curious. Ask questions. Engage other people. Will you help me? I don't know what I'm doing. I want to talk to you about this thing. I have no idea to have this conversation with you. And I'm really scared if I talk to you about it that you're going to punch me in the face or you're going to abandon the relationship or you're going to judge me. I'm terrified of that. Can we, like, are you interested in talking with me? And can we make some agreements so that can maybe minimize, be more strategic so I don't have to face that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I just, I'm thinking about the simplicity and beauty of sharing the weight of our worries with other people in our lives and how powerful that is. And yet so often I hear, I've been in this conversation with multiple friends over the years of, you know, and I know a lot of people, including myself too, when we get really in a really difficult place, like even the more difficult it is, mm-hmm. the harder it is to reach out because we feel like we need to be articulate. We feel like we need to be able to explain exactly what we're feeling and let the person in on every detail and that we need to offer them something. It's like a lot of hard work, you know, we need to offer them something, way to help us because they're going to feel powerless about it. And then we need to let them know that we're not too bad. Like we need to tie it up in a bow at the end, right? Like, so...
Right, yeah.
So no wonder we don't reach out to each other when we're struggling so hard, when we are carrying so much and we need to spread that out like you're describing. I don't know where I was going with that. I just thinking about just how often run into that. And I'm in the middle of a dialogue with a friend about that right now, actually. So, that's a beautiful thing.
You know, that all the stuff about being more honest in less high risk situations or less intense situations sets the stage for better experiences when the stakes are higher. Mm. You know, because when you're honest, like if you do the neutral reporting consistently in a relationship, the person you're doing it with begins to learn how you feel and how you interpret reality. And they will begin to adjust their dials and factor for that when they're dealing with you. And so that thing about how do you grow your capacity and how do you be honest and how do you do all these things, it's day-to-day embedding increasing amounts of honesty and clear communication and requests and engaging other people that has a cumulative effect and understanding until that there's enough experience cumulatively, it's going to feel very high risk. And you just got to suck it up, you know, and be as skillful as you can and communicate as clearly as you can and negotiate and co-create as much as you can to minimize how scary that's going to be for you. But you have to create different experiences, relational experiences, in order to create relationally potent neurological pathways that will then counterbalance the isolated, I don't trust people pathways. And that just takes time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're all like, oh, I don't want to do that. Okay. The story's more comfortable. The power trip's easier. Like, I could just do all this other stuff and avoid it. Why would I do that? Like, because you don't know how much happier and calmer and better and more secure and more existentially safe you feel when you're actually in relationships, reciprocal relationships. We're all used to how it feels when we're solo. So we're not incentivized to take the risk and do the work and subject ourselves to the discomfort and to our peril,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we don't know what's on the other side of that. We can't believe it. We can't imagine it. And it's extraordinary. You know, it's way better than flying solo, but flying solo works.
Mm-hmm.
It's less scary.
Yeah. And starting in those, practicing in those low stakes relationships sounds like, yeah.
Yeah.
Another question. Well, the question I had is about that incentive. You know, why, if this is what I've always known, I know how to be on my own. I know how to be, you know, hyper individual. And I get lots of pats on the back for that. I get lots of, you know, support to be that way. You know, what have you seen over the years, all the people you've worked with, like what happens to people when they start to make these shifts? I mean, you just talked about like some of the gifts that come, like it's far better, right? But can you talk a little bit more about the things you've witnessed? The shifts in people.
Yeah, I think the first thing for a lot of people is an intense feeling of grief.
Mm.
Of grief and confronting how lonely they've actually been that they weren't even aware of. You know, because we acclimate. It's like if honest relationship and genuine intimacy and community is not available, I just deal with it. But as soon as I have a lived experience, and it's not conceptual, and I actually have a lived experience of reciprocal relationship and community with another person, and now I see that it's possible, I'm going to mourn, like, I'm going to really feel how starving I've been for it. Like, if somebody says, look, what's a food you really like?
Chocolate.
Okay. And so let's say chocolate. So chocolate's really high in magnesium. It's got that great theobromine, however you say it. But if I tell you chocolate is not an option, it's not an option. And you don't know you crave chocolate because it's so high in magnesium and you don't seek out other sources of magnesium. You just do without chocolate, right? And you don't like walk around going chocolate, chocolate, chocolate. You're just like, chocolate isn't in the world. You know, I'm just going to live. Like, what do you do? There's all these other foods. It's great. I'm fine. Totally fine. Totally fine. But then you have chocolate and every cell in your body is like, I've needed this. My nerves are fried. I'm not having good neurological experiences because my magnesium's low and my heart skips beats because my nerve doesn't signal properly. And like my body's telling me this is what I've been needing.
Mm.
Right now you're becoming aware of how much you've been suffering without chocolate. You didn't even know all the things you've tolerated, all the things you've overlooked, all the things that you've ignored, all the things you've talked yourself out of, all the expectations that you have brought down and not allowed yourself to have, right? Not to mention the eros of chocolate, the aliveness, the like, oh, God, chocolate, right? So it's a similar thing. When somebody has an experience, usually what happens is it's during a session. They have the experience of being engaged relationally and realize like so many things have shifted for me just by being engaged with relationally. You didn't even do anything. Nothing even happened. I'm just feeling seen and valid and important and cared for, like with no layers between it. I'm just feeling that from you. Then all of the things that you've been missing rise up. And so that first part can really suck. It can really suck. And there's a grief period. And then after that, I think a lot more energy comes into your body and a lot more courage, what can start to come in. And then it's really collecting tools and practicing skills and growing your capacity so that you can be as relational as possible and just go for it and see, you know. And then it's like, oh my God, my relationships are happy. Everyone around me is so happy. Stuff's working better. The house flow is better. I got a promotion at work. It's better. Like people are being nicer in traffic. Like it's great. Everything's different because you're now literally living in a different realm. You're now more in the world rather than your bubble moving around. You know, and then if you extend that past humans and you get relational with everything, it can feel burdensome because the responsibility of care for other beings can feel like overwhelming. It's too much, but you'll grow your capacity for that. But you start getting relational with everything, and then pretty soon you don't feel lonely anymore. And you start getting over yourself, and you start feeling like a loyalty to the ecosystem rather than your own happiness. You start feeling like the health and the wellness and the thriving of the ecosystem is more important than your little individual life experience and your own little individual life. So now you're open to the experience of like death. You can start thinking about your own death instead of rejecting and avoiding death, right? You can start thinking about your own death and how that can benefit the ecosystem or how sad it's going to be for the ecosystem, you know, rather than I don't want to lose my life. And your purpose begins to change and your sense of meaning begins to change and the complexity begins to get more simple, right? When you're more tuned into the rest of the ecosystem. So a lot of things change and you know, allowing that to be very dynamic so that you're not taking the idea of what your life should be and forcing it onto a relational process. You just kind of let go of everything by becoming deeply curious and just kind of go on the ride and see where it takes you rather than control it and make it go to some place. And again, that freaks people out too.
Sounds like a lot less work.
It is a lot less work, but it's like,
in the long run, I guess.
In the long run, but it's higher risk work. It's a higher risk. You know, it's a perceived higher risk. I have found, you know, I used to be very misanthropic, I used to say I hate humans when I was younger. I hate humans. I love everything, every other life form, rocks, wind, sky, clouds, trees, grass, worms, maggots. I hate humans. And I had to do a lot of work to figure out how to be relational with humans in a way that didn't cause me to have to perform or forfeit or whatever, that I could be honest and relational. It took a lot of work. And since I've done that, what I have found is when you are honest with somebody, you're not being manipulative, you're not performing, you're not trying to do anything to them. You're just being honest. I have found the majority of people actually respond with care. They actually respond with care and kindness. And the ones who don't, it's a good filtering mechanism. But like strangers, shockingly, people will just respond with kindness when you're real with them. Whereas maybe they don't respond with kindness if you're not totally real. We can all feel it. That's the thing. We can all feel it, but we don't know what we're feeling. Like, I can feel you're not being real with me, But I don't know if it's because you're trying, if you're hiding something, if you're trying to manipulate me, or if you're playing a game, or if you're really shallow. Like, I don't know what it is. So I'm just going to hold back a little bit. But when you're honest, I can feel that, qualitatively feel the difference of that in my body. And I'm more inclined to show up, you know?
Yeah, what you describe is so much the same kind of process as unmasking, you know, or out, like that door about letting people into the real you, that you just get more choice about that. And the grief. I mean, I will say in both of those instances for me and unmasking, coming out, that there's, yes, I can, that resonates so deeply, that grief process of what was given up in order to fit in or to be in, to feel some kind of belonging.
Or to simply not be harmed. Not even to feel belonging, but just to dodge
harm. Yes. Yeah, as some kind of emotional or physical annihilation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, part of this is cultivating discernment, like really cultivating discernment. And, you know, the more you're able to feel your own honesty, it's so funny because I'll ask people, so how does that land for you? And they'll tell me their thoughts about how it landed. And I'm like, okay, so you just processed a bunch of stuff by yourself and then told me your conclusion. So before you started processing, what did you feel? Like, just tell me, like, what did you feel in your body when it first landed? People go, oh, my shoulders got clenched and I just like felt like I was going to break my teeth because I clenched my jaw so tight. I'm like, oh, so it stressed you out. Yeah, it totally stressed me out because your conclusion sounded like you were super chill, right? But that actually really stressed you out. It's like, I care that stressed you out. Is there anything I could have done differently so you didn't have the burden of having to force yourself through so much to be okay with it? Or to, like, what could I have done different? People are like, oh, like, we don't know it's an option. We don't know requests. We don't know that there are these relational options of co-creating. It's like we're playing a tennis match where, like, you hit the ball to me and then I'm worried about the ball and I forget you even exist. And I'm trying to do something with the ball, something good with the ball. And I hit the ball back to you and you look at the ball and you're not with me. Like, most people are relational, like a tennis match where we're trying to accomplish something, not with each other, but with this thing, whatever the thing is. And I think that learning how to be relational is really, you have to start with yourself really asking yourself, or work with a skillful practitioner who can ask you, like, well, what happened in your, but before you even tell me what you think, like, what happened, what's your body doing right now? You know? And a lot of us have body feelings with no language. There's no language pairing for the body feeling. You know, and like you're saying earlier, you have to be articulate or you have to be so sophisticated. Like, you don't. You can just tell somebody, I feel like I have a big green slimy ball in my stomach, and you are instantly going to know that I am like feeling scared or nauseated or disgusted. Like, those are some things I think of with a big green slimy ball in your stomach. Like, that can't feel good. Right. But even if I don't know the content, I know that you're not okay. And then I can respond with care for your well-being rather than us having some sophisticated conversation about, like, boundaries or, you know, whatever. It's like, I can just tell you, like, that sucks. And I'm sorry I contributed to a big green slimy ball in your stomach. I don't want that. You know, you want to figure out something else to do. Sorry. Let's talk about it. You know, there's opportunity for care rather than exchange.
Yeah. Yeah, it surfaces the love, like, immediately. Yeah, right? Ding. Is there anything more that you want to discuss before we close it out?
You know, I think I would just say to just be more enlivened and more open and more relational. I think it's really important for us to really let go of this idea that there's a right way to be. Really let go of the idea that there is a way to be an adult. There's a way to be whatever gender you are. There's a way to be whatever skin color you are. There's a way to be whatever social role you have. Just get over this idea that there's a right way to be and open yourself to discovering what is. And that's a pretty big ask for most people, but I have observed that people are killing themselves to try and appear right, that they're being a person the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, they're like, people are killing themselves to signal that they're right. And again, that's this invisible assumption that there's a right way to be a person.
Mm-hmm.
There's not. And to simply begin to really practice letting yourself off the hook, I think most people, without even realizing it, is it happens so fast and at such an unconscious level that they're in this constant process of finding themselves in a situation, performing what they believe is right on the situation, and then suffering the consequences of that, whether it's ruminating or second guessing or making a wrong decision or getting it right and feeling powerful and like they belong, only to feel lonely later, the impermanence of that dynamic. And not understanding that like when you assume that there's a right way to be in the world, whatever that means to you, like we all have our own versions of that. When you assume there's a right way to be in the world, you are now putting yourself in a very unalive, critical, boring position because everything you experience, you're comparing to an idea that you have. And then that creates urges to control or course correct or critique or power trip or whatever. It creates conditions for you to then, you're just being reactive all the time, but you're living in constant criticism. And when you're living in constant criticism going, I have an idea of what it should be, and then I'm going to compare what is to that and then decide if I like it or not, decide if it's okay or not, you're missing all the moments. You're missing so many miraculous things that are happening around you all the time. You're just missing it, just like my aunt, my mom, and my uncle did when they were standing in the driveway. They're missing the butterflies. They're missing the sun on the shiny cow bodies. They're missing the cats like being freaking adorable and getting dirty and rolling around. They're missing the apple tree blossoming, right? They're missing the green of the grass. They're missing the scent in the air. They're missing how the sun feels on their skin. They're missing the entire world thinking that their story is the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're missing life. And I don't know how you can't be anxious or depressed or tired when you're trying to just be in criticism all the time and you're not in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
And feeling starved
like,
for connection.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're literally starved for connection. Yeah. You actually are.
Yeah. All right, friends. That's our time for today. A warm thank you to Sadie for guiding us on this enlightening journey. If this episode left you wanting more, head over to Sadie's website, thedragonmother.com, where you'll find a treasure trove of transformational treats. There you can find her book, Savage Awakening, Initiatory Paths of the Dragon Mother, and learn more about her upcoming course called Between Earth and Sky, The Wild Wholeness of Belonging, launching May 1st. You can also meet her newly created Oracle cards, a companion deck to Savage Awakening, which are rich with powerful imagery and inspired insights. And be sure not to miss her deliciously witchy shop, chock full of sumptuously potent creations, including her new line of planetary potions. Check the show notes for links. You are cordially invited to join the Firekeeper's Bonfire. Like, comment, and subscribe to stay connected and become part of our new Patreon community. You can choose from the free option or the paid tier. Whether you come to meet like-minded folks, share your ideas, or simply show your support, your presence makes all the difference. Until next time, rock on in love.